And as a warning, I'll probably deliver the presentation to you, which might be weird, but that's...
Eye contact the whole time. I'm looking forward to it.
Hello and welcome to Lunchtime Lectures, the podcast. It's our very first one. And this month, the Lunchtime Lecture gang welcome David Thomas, the incredibly nimble delivery manager at one of the largest environmental regulators in the UK. Did everyone enjoy my agile joke?
Yeah, it was quality.
Thanks. And we're also joined by Tom Randall, a freelance UX designer. Hi, Tom.
Hi there.
So we'll be discussing what agile working is from an inside perspective, myths, tips, and how it can help you. So hi, Dave. Thanks for coming into FireRant. How are you doing?
Yeah, not too bad.
Good. So for those who are unfamiliar with the format of these lectures, they're normally around 20 to 30 minute talk with a presentation. So for obvious reasons, we'll have to rejig things to accommodate the podcast. But if you'd like to see Dave's beautiful presentation, I put the Google Slide links on the Meetup page. So in theory, you could listen and watch at the same time. I'll include the links to those in the description. But Dave, do you want to take it away?
Yeah. So today I'm talking about Agile and just giving a few kind of, I guess, giving a bit of a background to it, debunking a few myths and then giving a few tips and tricks. So we'll start with a bit of background for me. So my name is David Thomas, and I'm a delivery manager at DEFRA. So DEFRA is a Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs. So it's a government department that essentially takes care of our environment. I've spent the last 2 years of my career as a delivery manager and scrum master. So a scrum master and delivery manager, they're very similar roles, but essentially taking on a kind of team lead role within a development team. Prior to that, I spent 9 years as a developer. So I do have a technical background before going into more of a management type role. And almost all of that time has been spent working in agile teams. So today I'm going to be talking about what Agile is and what Agile isn't, running through a few myths about Agile, giving a few Agile techniques, because there's an awful lot of them, and then going into some real specifics about how Agile can be useful for the projects you might be working on. So we'll start with what Agile is and specifically with what Agile isn't. So the first thing that Agile isn't is a development methodology. So I think a lot of people compare Agile to more traditional methodologies like Waterfall and Prince and think that Agile is a new version of them or the opposite of them, that kind of thing. And that isn't really the case, as I'll go on to describe in a bit. The other thing that Agile isn't is Scrum. So Scrum is one of the things that led to the development of Agile and is very definitely a really important part of Agile. But Scrum and Agile are very definitely different things. So it's entirely possible to work in a Scrum environment and not be doing Agile, and it's entirely possible to do Agile and not do Scrum. One thing Scrum will help you do, though, is be more Agile. So it will kind of lead you in that direction, but they're definitely very different things. So a bit more about what Agile is. So at its core, it's a list of principles for developing software, and it can be expanded just to sort of a list of principles for developing anything in general. We'll get onto those principles in a moment. They form the Agile Manifesto. And once you've read and understood those principles and are working in that kind of way, I think it's sort of best been described as a mindset for how you approach development. One other thing that I think is really important to convey is that Agile really is a better way of doing things. So I've heard an awful lot that actually some projects you should take an Agile approach, some projects you take a more traditional approach. And the reality is Agile is a better way of doing things. And I think people can sort of see Agile as perhaps being a bit prescriptive, and when they do think it's a development methodology, that's why they can come up with this idea of, oh, well, maybe it's a development methodology that's appropriate in some circumstances but not in others, whereas the reality is it's not a development methodology, it's broader than that, and it really is just a better way of working. I think it's really helpful to have a look at the history of Agile in order to understand what it is. So there are a lot of things that you might have heard of from Agile, things like Scrum that I mentioned, extreme programming, and you might imagine that a bunch of people came up with Agile and then these sorts of techniques, these sort of processes came out of Agile, whereas actually it's the other way around. So in the 90s, software development, the approach to it was heavily based on principles from engineering. So in order to build a bridge, you really do have to do all your analysis or your design up front. So you want to figure out where your bridge is, you want to figure out what that bridge is going to look like, then you need to build it and you need to stress test it to make sure that it can take the weight that you designed it for before, yeah, you've signed it off and finished and you kind of go into maintenance on that bridge. That is, there's not really any other way of doing that. You can't sort of partially build a bridge, whatever. With software development, actually, that kind of approach didn't really work. Lots of people in the 90s had similar ideas on how to improve on this, and they wrote various books and came up with methodologies, and I've mentioned a couple of them already, Scrum and XP. There are other ones, such as the Pragmatic Programmer and so on. A huge number of people were improving on this, and they got together in 2003 and just kind of had a bit of a discussion about what was linking together all of their different ideas. They all knew they were sort of moving in the same direction, but doing it in slightly different ways, so they wanted to come up with an idea of what was linking that together. And so in 2003, they met together and they wrote the Agile Manifesto. And the Agile Manifesto is really at the core of what Agile is. So the Agile Manifesto is composed of four principles that are backed by 12 other values. But once you've understood those principles, you really understand enough in order to know how to use Agile in your environment. And these really are things that I go back to on a day-to-day basis in order to sort of understand how I should be working better. So each of those principles is written in the form of something over something else. So the first of them is individuals and interactions over processes and tools. And it's really important to understand that the things in the second half of this sentence, so processes and tools in this case, the Agile Manifesto is not saying that these things are unimportant or that we shouldn't have them. So no one's claiming that you should develop software without processes and tools. I mean, developing without a computer is going to be difficult. They're just saying that actually the first thing, individuals and interactions, are more important than those processes and tools. So I like to think of it that the processes and tools should be supporting those individuals and interactions. So I'll run through these principles and we can understand which of them means. So processes and tools, they're things like methodologies, prints, waterfall, scrum. Tools, you might use particular development environments, particular languages, particular things for deployment, particular techniques within development. None of those are the perfect way of developing. All of them should be supporting the individuals within your team and supporting the interactions within the team. So actually the most agile team that I've worked on was a group of three people who were three very competent developers. We sat together, we knew each other really, really well. We didn't follow a lot of the sort of more formal things that might come under the Agile umbrella, but because we sat together, because we knew each other really well, we worked really, really well together, and it was a really effective team. So the second principle is working software over comprehensive documentation. And again, this isn't that comprehensive documentation isn't useful, but it's just a recognition that it's not as important as having working software. And the other thing about comprehensive documentation is it can be very expensive to produce. So if you get to the end of the project and you've got some working software that's sort of easy to use, but actually you don't have the documentation to back it up, you've still got something valuable out there. Whereas if you get to the end of the project and all you've got is a large amount of documentation but no working software, you really don't have anything valuable. So definitely produce documentation, but just be aware of produce the right amount, produce stuff that's really, really useful and really is supporting you actually creating that software. The third point in the manifesto is customer collaboration over contract negotiation. So again, contract negotiation is sort of an inevitability, that's going to have to happen, but those contracts don't rely on the fact that that you're going to keep to those contracts, because actually if you sort of end up in a situation where you're going to court and you're suing each other based on those contracts, everyone's going to end up losing. So the real way that you achieve the best results is by collaborating really, really closely with your customers. So it doesn't have to be a zero-sum game. It doesn't have to be a game where if you win, the other side loses. You both want to succeed in a good relationship with a customer. The final point is responding to change over following a plan. So again, there's planning involved in Agile. You definitely want to plan. That can be useful. But again, planning can be expensive. And it's important to understand that things will change. The situation that you're working in will change. You'll get more feedback. Just the environment that you're developing in will change. And if you've invested a huge amount in planning, actually that's really expensive to replan every time you have to change, which makes you sort of averse to changing. So if you do the right amount of planning at the right time and to the right level of complexity, then you can respond to change more easily. So having gone through the... Go for it.
Dave, I've got a question about how you might distribute that through a team. I guess you've got a fairly big team, or and how does, say, a team where you might have contractors and freelancers, do you think it's important that everyone's aware of the manifesto, or do you distribute it through your team in some way, or
yeah,
how does that work?
So I think it is important for everyone within a team to have an understanding of the manifesto. I think different people will have different levels of understanding. So in the same way that, so I do have a relatively large team, it's about 10 people, we have, say, content designers within our team, and content designer will have a really, really strong understanding of how to write really, really good content that will help people use our service. I will also have a bit of an understanding of content design because it's important. The content designer will have a bit of an understanding of the Agile Manifesto. Now, this stuff is probably more important to me in my role as delivery manager than it is to the content designer, but actually it's still quite important to the content designer. So I would expect everyone within the team to have a level of understanding of this. Another reason that's really, really important is for those individuals and interactions. So it's important that the individuals interact well together rather than just me as delivery manager telling everyone what to do. So in order to interact well together, they probably need to understand some of these principles.
Okay, so you wouldn't have it printed out somewhere. You just make sure everyone's got an awareness.
So I don't have it printed out within my team, but actually I wouldn't think that was a ridiculous thing to do. And I know it's something I've done before with teams having a real awareness of the manifesto, or there's a similar technique. There's a Scrum checklist that's produced online for if you're following Scrum. And yeah, you just kind of share that with the team and say, right, we're going to follow Scrum. We're going to have this checklist that's up, and everyone in the team is going to understand that. And you could do something very similar with the manifesto and say, right, actually, each of these decisions we're making, how are they following the principles within the Agile Manifesto?
Okay.
So yeah, I think a high level of understanding within the team is quite important.
Okay, sounds good.
So having gone through the manifesto, we're just going to talk about a few myths that are around about Agile. So the first one there is that there's no planning in Agile. And I think this really comes from that fourth manifesto principle of responding to change over following a plan. And as I've said, the fact that responding to change is more important than following a plan doesn't mean that you shouldn't do any planning. What we tend to have in Agile is what we call planning horizons. So this means that you plan to an appropriate level of detail for the appropriate horizon. So if something is a long way in the distance, if we're talking 5 years off, you might have a bit of a goal there, you might have an idea in mind, but you're not going to plan in detail for that. If something's 6 months off, actually you want to start having a bit more of an understanding of where you're going to be then. Finally, if you're looking in 2 weeks or even a day, you're going to have a much more detailed idea of what you're going to be doing over that sort of timescale. So it's not that there's no planning in Agile, but unlike some more traditional methodologies, you don't have a really, really detailed plan for the entire length of your project. Next up is the myth that there's no documentation in Agile. And in a similar way to the last myth, this probably comes back to the Agile Manifesto and the idea that we should have working software over comprehensive documentation. And I think some people do sort of use Agile as a bit of an excuse to not do any documentation, but yeah, it really is an excuse there. It's not that documentation is bad or that we shouldn't do it, it just shouldn't be the first thing that we do within a project. So in more traditional projects where you do have that big analysis and design up front, halfway through the project, all you will have is a huge amount of documentation. Whereas within Agile, when we're working in a bit of a more iterative fashion, you'll do a little bit of design, a little bit of planning, and then do some development. So you always have far less documentation. The other thing that you might get in traditional projects, because they tend to be a bit more formally structured, an awful lot of documentation is done for its own sake. It's you write a closure report at the end of a project because you write a closure report. I actually went on a project management training course where the trainer did say exactly that. He said, you write yourself a closure report at the end of the project and you file it in a cupboard and no one ever reads it. And we all kind of put our hands up and said, well, if no one's ever going to read it, why do you have to do it? And he said, you do. And the answer is actually, you don't. If no one's ever going to read it, don't produce it. So next up is that Agile is unstructured. And this, again, isn't the case. And it in order for Agile to work effectively, particularly with larger teams, a fair amount of structure and discipline is actually really, really important. What you will tend to find, though, is it is less structured than some of the more traditional methods. An awful lot of this comes from the fact that Agile teams will tend to create the structures that are necessary for them at that particular time. So rather than saying there's this one-size-fits-all approach that we're always going to use, you figure out the structures that work for you at that particular time. So there are obviously techniques and methodologies within Agile, and most Agile teams will use some of these. But yeah, it's not that it's unstructured, it's just that you use the right amount of structure for the particular environment that you're in. Which leads us on nicely to the next myth, which is that Agile is overly structured. So this comes a bit more from perhaps people who haven't been following any particular methodology. And you can imagine you're working in a small team, someone comes along and says, right, we're doing Scrum, you've got to have retrospectives, you've got to have planning meetings, you've got to have daily stand-ups, and all of a sudden this feels very onerous. There's lots of time spent in meetings and not much time actually delivering stuff, when actually perhaps you were working quite well before. The thing to understand here is that you really need to be pragmatic, and Agile encourages that. So you just introduce the level of structure that you need. So if there's two or three of you in a team, you talk to each other all of the time, you're working well, you're improving as you work, you don't need all of those formal meetings that maybe come in Scrum. You perhaps just need to carry on working as you're working, and that really is what Agile's about. And the final one, which is my favourite, is that Agile is for purists. So as someone who talks about Agile a lot, I also consider myself incredibly pragmatic. This works, this actually gets software out there. The big traditional methodologies would have a tendency to promise an awful lot, and you'd find out really, really late in the day that it hadn't worked and you hadn't delivered. Whereas Agile, like I said, very pragmatic. It's about doing what works, doing what adds value, and sort of proving that really, really early. So yeah, when people talk about Agile for being for purists, it's actually kind of the other way around. One thing you do sometimes get is Scrum purists, so people saying you should always follow Scrum to the letter, by the book. And yeah, the fact is that's not Agile. So that kind of, I talked about it earlier in the talk. If you're doing Scrum, you're not necessarily doing Agile. And if you're always doing Scrum by the book and refusing to do anything else, well, actually you're not improving as you work, which is a really important part of Agile. So you're not really being Agile. So next, I'm going to talk a little bit about a few techniques that come under the umbrella of Agile and can help you in the way you work. So the first of those is estimation. So estimating how the size of tasks, how difficult they're going to be, is done quite differently in the world of Agile compared to traditional projects. So the traditional approach might be to break down all of the work that you've got, figure out in days how long each task is going to take, add it all up, and then you've got your estimate. Within Agile, we tend to use relative estimation instead of absolute. So an absolute estimate is how long something is going to take in days. A relative estimate is how long a certain task is going to take compared to another task. So in order to do this, we use arbitrary units called story points. So this will work by selecting one of your smaller tasks, so-called stories, and giving it value of a one, and then you estimate other things relative to this. So if you've got something that's twice as big, you'll give that a two. If it's three times as big, you'll give it a three. You then will work for a period of time and see how quickly you complete story points. So you'll work for a week or 2 weeks and say, all right, we completed 20, 30 story points worth of work. Now, if you're estimating all of your other stories compared to the ones that you've completed, you start to get a really good idea of how long the work that you've planned is going to take. And this works really, really well, because humans genuinely are better at relative estimation than they are at absolute estimation. So if I asked you to estimate how long it's going to take you to paint a room, people might really struggle with that. You might say it's going to take a day, it's going to take 5 days. It's hard to understand exactly how long that's going to take unless you've done it an awful lot before. Whereas if I say, right, it's going to take you a day to paint a room, how long is it going to take you to paint four rooms? Well, you could pretty quickly say, well, it's going to take 4 days. Well, you might say, actually, there's a bit of overhead that we're eliminating. It might take 3.5 days or 3 days, but you'll have a much more accurate picture of how long that's going to take. One of the things about this is that we're worse at estimating things as they get larger. So it's more difficult to say this piece of work is 20 times this other piece, or this is 50 times another piece. So in order to account for this, we tend to estimate using the Fibonacci sequence, so 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, 13. And we'll typically stop at 13, because once you've got beyond that, then you're into really large stuff and the estimates tend to get really inaccurate. The other thing is, this should be quite a quick method of estimating. So you want to put things in these buckets. If you're not sure if something's a 5 or an 8, pick one, go with it, and things will tend to even out over time. Finally, relative estimation can work very well for smaller projects. So if all of your projects tend to take just a couple of days or 3 days, what can work really, really well is if you've got a bit of spare wall space in your office, start to put up cards representing your projects on the wall and order them by how long they take. When you get a new project in, write that up on a card and put it on the wall relative to the other projects based on how long you think it's going to take. You can then go back, have a look at those other projects and make an estimate for this new project. One thing that's really important when you're doing this relative estimation is to make sure that you don't bring time back into it, because your brain is sort of desperate to estimate in an absolute fashion despite the fact it's quite poor at it. So when you're looking at story points, if you convert them into time, then you'll just end up estimating in your head in time and convert that to story points. Again, if you use that technique of having the projects up on the wall, don't have the days that they took up on the wall, because otherwise you'll end up estimating based on that rather than on the actual relative size of the project.
Hi Dave, just on the estimation, do you find that it's difficult to have a consistent estimation within your team, or is that something that builds over time, or do you have any recommendations on keeping that consistent?
Yeah, so it's something that definitely builds over time. It's something that people can be quite uncomfortable with at first. I think the main mistake people make is being too desperate to get the story point estimates exactly right. So if they see it as these as not precise estimates, but rough estimates that won't necessarily be correct for an individual story, but will be correct across 5 or 10 stories, then that really helps. One technique that I've used that's worked really, really well is a bit like the technique I was describing for estimating projects. So instead of sitting down and asking people to assign story points to all of their stories, simply putting all of the items of work up on a wall together, seeing which are the smaller ones, which are the larger ones, and then giving them size estimates based on that.
And would you do that as a team exercise?
Yes, so it's really important with the estimation to approach that as a team exercise. So in general, you want everyone who's going to be involved in doing the work involved in estimating the work. So as a delivery manager, when we're sitting in these estimating sessions, I will not say anything. I won't give an estimate at all. Similarly, our product manager, who's the one who's responsible for deciding what work we're going to do, he's not allowed to say anything either. That's really important that the people who are doing the work are estimating it. In order to avoid this taking a huge amount of time, if you do have a team of 10 people, say, one technique that's used is what's known as three amigos estimating. So you get three different people who represent three different disciplines within your team to come together and do a bunch of estimating together. So again, it's not quite as good because you don't have everyone's input, but actually it's a much quicker way of doing it because you're only using three people from the team rather than the whole team of, say 10 people. So typically those disciplines might be design, development and test is what you'd really expect there. Depending on the makeup of your team, you might have different people.
Okay.
So the next technique that I wanted to introduce was the idea of visualizing your work. So what this really means is just sharing what work you've got coming up, what work you're currently working on, and what work you've just finished. So basic kind of board with to do, doing, done on it. And so ideally, this should just be in the form of a whiteboard in your office if you're working in the same physical location as your colleagues. You simply have three columns: to do, doing, done, and then you have cards or post-its representing your items of work. And you move them across the board as you progress them. So really, really simple, but really effective. If you're not working in the same location as your colleagues, then there's a whole bunch of online tools that you can use for this. Trello is probably the most prominent of the free ones anyway. use an online alternative if you can't do it using a physical board. So why is this important? One of the reasons, it really helps communicate with people what work is being done, and particularly in larger teams, that's really, really important. You can't constantly be asking everyone else what they're doing, what they need help with, that kind of stuff. So if you've got that up and visible, that's really, really helpful. The other benefit with this is it can help minimize work in progress. So people are actually really, really terrible at multitasking. So we sort of like the idea of multitasking. If you're juggling three things, then you're working three times as fast, but actually you end up doing each of those things very badly. Visualizing your work like this makes it really obvious when you've got too much work in progress. So if you've got a massively full doing column, you can just see that, move everything back into to do and put it on hold for the moment.
Do you use any other task tracking software alongside this technique? I mean, obviously you use Jira a fair amount and things like that. Where does the crossover lie between these two sort of systems?
Jira started out as a task tracking software, but then sort of really formed around this kind of what they call Kanban boards. And so, yeah, we end up using Jira for all of that. You do get a tiny bit of that with Trello, but you get more of it with Jira. So really, it's just about finding out what you need, what's helpful for you. So if having the history of all the stuff that you've worked on is really important, having that easily accessible, then, yeah, spending a bit of extra money and getting Jira and dealing with the extra complexity of Jira compared to Trello, I would definitely recommend that. If, yeah, on the other hand, you don't need that, if you're working on a small project or if the history isn't so important, then, yeah, use Trello. I guess having that history there is really, really useful. And I know one thing that is done within teams is actually having a physical board and having a Jira board. So if you can have that physical board, it is really useful. And then it's usually delivery manager or scrum master's responsibility to keep the two in sync. So there is obviously some overhead there. But you get the benefit of having that physical board as well as having all of the history and all of the discussion that you can have on tasks and so on. So the reason I say that the physical board is so important and is valuable, even if you have got things like Jira, is just it's that much more visual. So one thing you really notice when you're using a physical board, you can see other people going up, picking off tasks, see what they're working on next, and yeah, you can see when essentially people have a bit of downtime, and this really promotes kind of discussion around that board, encourages people to collaborate a little bit more.
Okay, so there's nothing wrong with doing both. Could have a visual board and a sort of digital version.
Yeah. So the only problem with it is the overhead of keeping in sync, but
yeah,
I definitely think a lot of teams find that overhead worthwhile.
Okay.
So the next technique I was going to talk about is iterative development. So what I mean by that is to deliver a small amount of functionality really early. It's really important that it's high quality and that it delivers some sort of value to the users, but you deliver that as early as possible, but then build on that really quickly and carry on releasing over and over again. So this is as opposed to the sort of more traditional approach of you do your first delivery right at the end, you call it Big Bang delivery, you deliver everything in one chunk at the end of the project. The benefit of iterative development is the most obvious one, but perhaps not the most important one, is that you deliver value early, so you get something in the hands of people really early on. If you imagine you've got a year-long project, it would be great if people could start getting some of the benefits of the system after a month instead of after a year. Probably the most important one, though, is that it discovers issues early. So really the first time you properly discover anything about the system that you're building is that when you get it in the hands of users who are really using it in anger. Now, if you do that after a month and discover that you've been going in the wrong direction for a month, that's great. You can change direction. You've got another 11 months to improve on that. If you first discover that after a year and you've been building the wrong thing for a year, that's really, really problematic. The other thing that theoretically doesn't sound that important, but I think is absolutely huge in reality, is that it really reduces the risk of never delivering. So if you imagine a year or a 2 year project, the chances of that not actually ever delivering are going to be huge. The chances of the people who are funding it, the senior stakeholders, losing interest, the whole thing losing momentum, that's really serious. And I've worked on slightly more traditional projects where you sort of look at all of the risks of the project at the start and you talk about security risks, technology risks, all of those sorts of things. The real risk at the start of every project is essentially people are going to lose motivation, people are going to lose funding, and you never deliver. And no one ever really talks about that. But by delivering really, really early, you remove that risk, or reduce it anyway. So to finish off, I wanted to go back to the manifesto and talk about how each of those principles in the manifesto can really be made practical, can be made useful for you. So the first one is individuals and interactions over processes and tools. I think the really important thing here is to not be that person who has their favourite process or has their favourite tool. I've worked in multiple languages, using multiple development environments, using different processes throughout my career, and the worst thing you can do is be that person who has their favourite process, who always wants to use Scrum, who has their favourite language, thinks that Java solves all problems. Essentially, use the processes and tools that support the individuals and interactions within your team. If you are a Java developer, say, but you move into an organization where everyone else knows C#, well, even if you've loved Java and been using that all your career, the individuals you're going to be working with are going to be better at C#, so use that. Similarly with processes, if you've got a really, really big team, then following Scrum really, really tightly might be useful. But actually, when you're down to two or three people, following all of that process might not actually help the interactions between those people. So just choose what's appropriate for your situation. The next one is working software over comprehensive documentation. So really here, it's about getting working software into the hands of your clients early. So if you've been given 2 weeks to complete a project, maybe you're building a website for someone, find out what would be a useful portion of that website and deliver that as quickly as possible. So deliver the front page of what you're doing within a couple of days. If you've been given a couple of weeks, the fact that you're delivering after a couple of days is really, really going to blow away your client and sell them on the whole approach that you're taking. The other thing is often talked about, you get kind of 90% of the work goes on 10% of the value. So you do the bulk of everything and then you end up spending a huge amount of time doing just little bits at the end. Well, if you deliver after 2 days, actually you might well be delivering the vast bulk of the value really, really early on. The third point is customer collaboration over contract negotiation. So here it really is about not tying yourself to those contracts. And that's going to be difficult, particularly with agency work or smaller projects, because people will want contracts. You're never going to get away from that. So accept that, be happy with that. But once you've got that, don't keep relying on that contract. Collaborate with your customers. And I think one of the best ways of doing this is to actually sit yourself with your customers. So if you've got an office for your team, if you've got a bit of space in that office, if you're spending 2 weeks developing a website for someone, get someone from that organization to come and sit within your office. Most people can work fairly remotely from what they do if they're sort of dealing with emails or whatever most of the time, so they might like the change of scenery, come and work with you. Alternatively, they might have a bit of space in their office and you can go and sit with them. Now, the benefit of this is you'll be so much more embedded in the culture of the way they're working. You'll have such a better understanding of what they're trying to achieve. So it's much more likely that they'll get the end result that they're after, and you will too. It also helps an awful lot when you've got questions to ask. So you can imagine you're building something for someone, you fire off an email, they take half a day to reply. Well, actually on a small project, that's a really large chunk of time. Whereas if you're sitting next to them, you can just turn to them and say, oh, how should this be? And they can look over your shoulder. It's a lot more visual, a lot easier to work, and can be really, really helpful. And the final principle is responding to change over following a plan. So following this principle, the practical way of doing this is just to plan at the right level. So be comfortable with uncertainty, not complete uncertainty, but just a level of uncertainty. So essentially planning for stuff that doesn't happen is a form of waste. So if you plan at the right level, you can avoid that waste and you'll end up being an awful lot more comfortable responding to change. So that's everything I wanted to cover today.
Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
No worries. And you can follow Fireant on Twitter. If you wanted to see a lunchtime lecture in the flesh, you can come to one of our talks in Bristol. If you just join the meetup page, all the links will be down below. But thank you everyone for listening.